it's just such a pleasure to have Mike Devonshire here today to talk about Tanata Peak. Since I've been involved in landmarks, every time there's been a survey or we've talked about the iconic places of Hawke's Bay, Tanata Peak comes out every time at the top. And it has always reinforced just what an icon it is. And I think Tanata Peak just represents a difference, and that's been the joy of it over the years. Mike, what is your official position at the Tanata Trust?
So I'm a trustee and I'm the chair of the board. Yeah.
Over to you, Mike. Thank you.
Okay, all right. Well, thank you everyone for inviting me here today. Tanata Park is ours forever. That's really the message that I want to get across today. So just by way of introduction, I was appointed to the Trust Board just over 4 years ago now. And prior to that, if you will recall, there was going to be a planned visitor centre up at the main car park. So the Trust Board engaged me at the time to do a review of that. And what I recommended was that, no, we should not do that, because it'll be a white elephant, won't be able to be sustained. And then at the same time, I wrote a review of the governance structure of the Trust Board, and that was fine, I left that. And then the next thing I knew, I had a call from the mayor saying, would you mind getting involved in the trust and helping us implement this thing? I said, no. Anyway, so here I am. And I guess after about a year of being appointed to the trust, I assumed the chair role. So let's just get into it, because this is part of our story, our vision, which I'm going to explain or show you today. But there's a lot more to come, and there's a lot more work being done, which will become apparent in time. So here we go. We are the kaitiaki of the maunga, so we must protect the past whilst planning for the future. Now that's a bit of a dichotomy, isn't it? How can you do that? You know, how do you look backward to look forward? That's a challenge for all of us. But history tells us it's the right thing to do. Right, well, we know a bit about history, don't we? We all know about the legend of Temata, the Waimarama chief. And we knew that the Māoris had been over that mountain for many, many centuries. And prior to that, who knows what else was ranging around there as it was uplifted. But the facts of the matter in terms of European history are in 1862, the land was purchased by John Chambers from the Crown, and eventually three of the Chambers brothers gifted the land in perpetuity to the people of Hawke's Bay. So that is still the case. It is a privately owned asset, owned by the Trust, for the benefit of the people of Hawke's Bay. You could probably read New Zealand, and you could probably read the world in that. And then there were further sort of steps made around the QE2 Open Spaces Covenant. So effectively, above a certain level, 200 metres, there's quite strict requirements about what you can and can't do for the open grassland there. So the way we think about things, we sort of chunk the maunga down. So there's the natural environment. Some of you probably know it's a Hawke's Bay limestone structure from a geological point of view. It's pretty light soil, so it, you know, dries out quickly, not that fertile, and we have our issues around maintaining it or looking after it. In terms of vegetation, before the humans arrived, it was a dense forest, like most of New Zealand was. It was covered in forest. It was teeming with wildlife. The Māori came, they started to clear, do works, planted certain species which they used to, you know, thrive upon, so eat and use for various crafts. And there's evidence of that throughout the park still. As some of you may know, there are groves of trees, and there are a few sites, midden sites and other sites of archaeological significance, and they are identified. And there are some plans and programs around that. So we can talk about that a bit later if you so wish. Obviously, when the Europeans came, like they did throughout most of New Zealand, they started to graze and produce various, you know, products. And also, over time, some forestry was planted with a view to, you know, some commercial return. And it should be worthwhile noting that there are remnants of native coastal forests which are specific, unique to the park, still deep in the heart of it. So we have a management plan which you may be familiar. This was something that was established probably about 6 years ago now. It's actually been superseded, but I'll just talk about it, and I can talk about what's coming in terms of our whole planning. But as you can see, so this is the park here, sort of in this wider area. You can just see through here. I won't go into the detail there, but there are different pockets of plantings which were pretty much, let's say, ad hoc over the last sort of 70 or 80 years. But we got pine, obviously we've got the redwood grove, which we have the original receipts for, the purchase of the seedlings, quite amazing. And they were planted pretty much around the time of the establishment of the park. So about 1927 was the first purchase of redwoods. And then there was a secondary purchase, the smaller grove of redwoods, which is near Chambers Walk, if you're familiar with the park. They were planted in the early 70s. So there's a lot of natives, Karaka, Nio, and some Makakapa. And then there's a bunch of introduced exotics, so the cypress, the Douglas fir, eucalyptus, cedars, and poplars, and obviously there's some pine. So down in here, this is what we call the old plantation block. That's just come out, and I'll talk about that in a minute. We've harvested that. And then up in here, that's the old plateau. Most of that pine's come out as well. We'll get onto that in a minute. So one of the other key purposes for us is encouraging and perpetuating native fauna. It's phenomenal, the amount of bird life in the park. And with our new plantings, we will see this increase. We also think about what's going on in the wider environment as well. And there's been a lot of work around encouraging fauna. So, you know, some facts there. Tuis and the bellbirds travel up to 30 k's to come and feed on our eucalypts in the winter. The kiraru and kingfisher and the fantails in particular, they're always in there, nibbling away. And they sort of range from right up to the top of the Rai-Totara and over to the Cape. So it's really something to behold when you're walking through the various forests that we have or pockets of trees to see all of these species. On occasion, we get kaka and the New Zealand falcon coming through. These are coming a bit more prevalent. And there's a picture of Mike Lusk there. Many of you may know Mike. He's the person who's worked tirelessly in the park. He knows where all the skinks and the geckos are. He won't tell us, but he knows they're in there. And he works tirelessly to protect those. So pest control is really a key element for us. So Mike, sort of like anti-cat, completely anti-cat. And obviously we have stoats and rat traps about the place. But he works with a group of volunteers. Some of you may be part of that group. For over 20 years, he's been working tirelessly in there. And the Friends of Tomato Park is his group. But there are other groups that we're encouraging and working with to help sustain and encourage this fauna. We obviously got, you know, quite a bit of biodiversity within our park and within our region, and that's something that we need to continue to encourage. Obviously, if you've got a vibrant biodiverse strategy, you will enhance and protect the various ecosystems and indigenous species that we have. So as I referred to before, there is a bird corridor, you know, the Cape to the City project, and we're part of that, I guess, that chain. There's a real focus for us to work on plant pests, reduction of that, and on animal pests, as I alluded to before. We've got to work cooperatively, both with our neighbours, whether they're landowners, and our key stakeholders, both the regional council and the district council. And we do meet regularly and talk about this sort of stuff, and we are organised and funded to deal with that. And obviously we've got, you know, some sensitive areas ecologically that we want to protect. Wetland development is another area, so that's on our radar. We've got some wetlands that we're looking after. We'd like to develop more, but that's really down to a function of time and money. And with all of these things, there's a balance between the values of people who want to get out and recreate and build a track or run or walk or whatever they want to do. Birdwatch, that's fine. There's a deep cultural and spiritual connection to the peak. So there's, you know, heartfelt values around that. And obviously, we've got our ecological values as well. So there's a balancing act. You know, there's conflict at times, but like anything, conflict's good in the sense that the issues come out and we discuss it and we try and work towards a decent resolution. But it's all about vision as far as we're concerned. And the vision's got to be to protect and then you enhance in the best interest of those values. So it's quite an interesting area and fraught with debate. Okay, everyone's got a view on Tomato Park. Everyone. And it's great to hear them. We know, we've measured this. There's been at least 1 million visitors a year coming to the park in a car. So it might be people coming 3 or 4 or 10 times, but it's 1 million visits in a car. That's a lot. So we've got two entrance points, remember, Tauroa and up through the main gates. So what have we got? Well, we've got 99 hectares, of which about 5 hectares is road reserve. So the road that comes up, that's actually owned by the district council because they maintain that road. But the rest, everything's around it, is 99 hectares. And our recent purchase of 8.5 hectares, what we call the Jack's Block, you may have seen, but we are developing that. And it'll basically integrate into the park. So we are privately owned, but we're publicly funded. And we don't get a lot of money from the district or the regional council from an operational point of view. And we have to look outside to manage that, you know, to fund all our activities. And I can talk about that in more detail later. One of the biggest issues for the Trust Board is growth. Growth in the sense that more and more people want to come. And what we've seen, probably in the last 5 years, I think it's safe to say the volume of people accessing the park has more than doubled. and it is putting a lot of pressure on it. And that was one of the reasons we did purchase the new block, to actually open up opportunities and reduce some of that congestion. But along with that, you know, the increase in traffic, the major issue is safety and safety on the road. So the irony of that situation is, from a trustee point of view or from a governing point of view, we don't own the road, we don't control the road, but our biggest risk is on the road. So like anything, balancing conflicting wants and desires. So obviously, alluding to this user group conflict, some people think it's great, we should shut the road and then we can walk up it. But I want to walk up it, but you can't ride on it. So hang on. So there is a continuing conflict around that. It's not a negative thing in the sense that people have a view, and that's fine. We can work through that, and we will. But everyone's got a view, as I said before. And we do have bottlenecks. So, you know, designing or planning to alleviate those pressures is a key function for us and a key concern. From a more prudential management, you know, we don't want the environment to be pressured by the amount of people. So we don't want to be cutting, where possible, wider roads or putting in, you know, a myriad of access tracks. There has to be very careful balancing around that. And obviously at the same time, we want to be, you know, planting efficiently and effectively and sympathetically to the environment. You know, that is a major concern for the Trust Board, and we do focus on it. And then this bottom one is really interesting, because I've been in the national press, you may have seen me, in discussions with some people of probably less savoury nature about how they want to access the park and do patching ceremonies and various things. Everyone has a right to access the park, there's no doubt about that. It's just what you do when you're there and how you respond to others, that's really the key concern for us. But, you know, it's like anything, you've got to be careful. Sometimes you can be a victim of your own success. So the ambience of the park is pretty critical. It's a hugely spiritual place and very culturally significant. So that's part of our balancing act. Anyone want to be a trustee? Okay, so this is our vision. And this is where it begins and this is where it ends. So this is what I went to the first time I got involved with this park, because it's fundamental. The vision drives the objectives, it drives the strategy, and then it drives what you do from the back of that. So, Te Mata Park is a tanga tuku iho, a heavenly gift, and an iconic feature of Hawke's Bay. I would say the iconic feature, but that might ruffle a few feathers, but I believe it. This is lifted out of the trust deed. It will always be a place of cultural, scenic, recreational, scientific, and educational significance for all New Zealanders. The Trust will sustain, enhance, protect, and maintain, and there's conflict in that phrase, Te Mata Park's outstanding natural features and open spaces. And needless to say, it's recognised by others as being a very, very significant place. And we've got a quote there from the Hastings District Council's district plan. The single most significant landscape icon in Hawke's Bay, having district, regional, and national significance. Well, I agree with that. It is the most prominent landmark in the eastern Hiratonga Plains with a distinctive silhouette style, skyline. So that's a fact. It is a source of identity for both Hastings and Havelock North resident and Ngāti Kahanunu. So I would say significant to all people of Hawke's Bay and the wider area. But anyway, so our vision is to sustain, enhance, protect, and maintain. So our objectives, they're driven off the vision, of course. To korora and strengthen our relationship with tangata whenua, and weave the voice of mana whenua into the planning and policy making of Te Mata Park. And I'll talk about that in a minute, because we have done that. We have changed the trust deed to give effect to that. To enhance and expand Te Mata Park. Now, I'm not in the business of, you know, getting another 150 hectares or something like that, but it's about what we need to do. To understand the behaviours and preferences of park users, enabling sustainable and prudent management of the park. Now, this is key. When the Trust Board effectively stopped the development of the visitor centre, we said to them, look, why don't we ask the users what they want? So, do you want a big visitor centre? No. What do you want? I'd like to get a drink of water and go to the loo if possible. That was all they wanted. Everything else was all right, thank you. So, if you don't ask, you don't get. So, we continue to ask regularly through surveys in the park, and some of you have helped us with the surveys, and reflect back. It's not channeled down one area, it's an open book. What do you want? You know, I'm always concerned about what people are worried about. You know, what's worrying you? What's the problem? Okay, well, what's your response to that? So the communication, the korero, is really, really important. Because once we understand behaviours and preferences, then we can start to go about designing or fixing or making it better. We'll try to anyway. Okay, now this next one is very dear to my heart, which is to build significant financial resources to enhance, protect and sustain Tamata Park. So we are like the bamboo in the wind. You know, we don't really have a big structure behind us at the moment. We don't have solid resources. We've got a bunch of stakeholders who try to blow this way and that and, you know, try and influence you in a certain direction. But the fundamental fact is we're a privately owned asset and the Trust Board is there to preserve it and look after it. So to do that, we've got to be able to be resourced adequately, in fact, more than adequately. So that's one of our key challenges. I can talk to that in a minute. And this bottom one here is probably what underpins, I guess, the kaitiaki element of what we do, to nurture an environment for the recreational, spiritual, cultural and educational benefit of the public. So communication is key. So I understand this is being recorded for the Knowledge Bank. This philosophy around communicating has been probably one of the areas where the Trust Board has not let itself down, but just hasn't really got on the front foot. And that is that we haven't told our story. And our story is an amazing story because we exist for the benefit of the people. Okay, that's what we exist for. And the reason we exist is because it's a place that should be protected and it should be explained and people should learn. So that's our future for the next 100 years really. And that's our vision. Our vision is a 100-year vision. That's what we've put in place now. So if you think it through, you know, our children's children's children, you know, should be imbued with an understanding and a want to nurture this environment as well. So, you know, the big objectives. At a fundamental level, is stewardship from a trustee perspective, and we've got to have a real clear and keen focus on what we need to do. So the governance, we've established a very clear, almost not a corporate governance, I suppose, but I've got a clear governance structure. We've got a trust board, we've got subcommittee structures, we've got terms of reference, we're minuted, we engage with our stakeholders strategically. We're building a master plan at the moment, which will be as good as anything around here in terms of how it's organised, described, communicated. So, you know, getting organised is half the battle in life. So getting organised around a plan, reviewing it regularly, having structures to support, that's really, really important. That flows down into how we manage the park. So we've got a manager. Didn't have a manager when I started. We've got someone to help her as well. She's a comms person. She can be a manager as well. So we've built resilience in the organisation already. And then we have a communication strategy around our key stakeholders and our wider community, and also people that we engage with in terms of contractual arrangements and stuff like that. Sustainability, so the pressure, that's really, you know, why we have this organisation, why we have this planning focus. We've got to be able to deal with the issues that are in front of us and future issues as well. So as I mentioned before, preservation, protecting what we've got, the integrity of the place, that's really, really important. And it is a beautiful place. So, you know, whatever we do, we've got to be careful about how we implement any changes, if at all. Health and safety is a fundamental concern for everyone nowadays, as it always has been. You know, we're living the COVID reality right now. Probably a good place to get up and out away from the COVID thoughts up there. I know through level 4, I was up there on my bike. It was wonderful. But health and safety is a continuing concern. How you communicate, what you've got, what you need to be aware of, what you need to be not fearful, but probably how you engage with people who want more out of the place. They need to be aware that there's certain challenges in there. We can't have a bunch of signs everywhere saying there's a cliff, be careful. But you can communicate that there are issues. You can design your track network to accommodate and incorporate safety. There's a whole bunch of stuff like that that has to be thought through. But at the end of the day, we've got to be very mindful of that. Where we're going, educational programs. So we are engaging with youth and with, you know, young children, and that's really demand driven by them. But we've learned through sustainability programs and various other things that are initiated by some of our key stakeholders, there's a huge thirst to learn. So why not learn within the park? So that's our basic philosophy there. And we're very, very mindful that there's a deep cultural heritage, both for Māori and European. So we need to continue to develop the story around that and keep that engagement going. So that's a key focus for us. And then, like I'm doing today, having a chat within the community about what we're up to and getting probably feedback from people as well about what they feel about that and what they understand or don't understand, because it all builds for our story. But fundamentally, we need to collaborate more. We see ourselves as probably a leader in terms of park management, or should be. But also, you know, if we hold things dear, like I've just described, you know, why wouldn't the community come along for the ride? If we're all involved on that level, fundamentally, we'll be in a better place in time. So what have we done in recent times? Well, You're probably all aware that we work collaboratively with the District Council to develop our two main car park areas. So there was some generous funding from both the District Council and a lesser extent from the Regional Council with this specific project in mind. But the success of this project outweighed our wildest aspirations. So it's become a destination in its own right. We just thought it would be, you know, come in here, go to the loo, wash your hands, have a bit of a look. People come up here, families, and as you're probably aware, there's various seats around the place to go and have lunch, just at the main gate car park. Great. But it's brought some challenges with it, and I'll get onto it in a minute, but you know, we've developed off the back of that the new block as well. But what we've learned through this, you know, we worked well with the District Council. We had a joint planning initiative. They've got some really good landscape planners in there, and jointly project managed it, and it was a good job. So, you know, it was a really good outcome. You may be aware we've got new tenants. We've had a few false starts in recent years with tenants, but we've got some fantastic tenants in Peak House, a young couple who are very styly, very commercially minded, and quite entrepreneurial, so they've got a bunch of interests, and they have really taken it to a new level. And that's great because, you know, in our surveys, everyone was asking, when's Peak House open? You know, when can I have my 21st or my wedding there or whatever? On the 60th or the 70th or whatever it is. So, you know, we're over the moon about that, and we've invested quite a bit of money just bringing it back up to a standard, remembering it was designed and I think opened in 1965, primarily as a caretaker's sort of shed and a bit of a tea rooms. So back in the day when they were designing bus tours and stuff up there. So anyway, it's come a long way. So a new land, is everyone familiar with the purchase of the land? So there was a real strategic reason. We had the Tauroa car park here, and at the top up here is the Main Gates car park. Chambers Walk's only about 15 metres wide. It's the only strip of land that we had till you got to this point down here, which was opening up into the main park. So there's a lot of pressure on Chambers Walk from all range of users. So that obviously, with opening this sort of area up, you know, give us the opportunity to alleviate those demands. And there's quite a safety element to it as well. There's sort of people crossing over and bikes and walkers and God knows what was happening. So we thought, well, here's the opportunity to get this and incorporate it into the wider park. We were also concerned that there was going to be some further development as it's sort of creeping up the hillside there. So that ensured that we wouldn't be stuck with a couple of garish houses or whatever, maybe five or six houses, who knows. And as it's transpired, it's been a magnificent purchase, really. Right now, we're in the middle of building some tracks. We've got a lot of resource consents and various things. And we've already planted in that block probably about 5,000 plants and trees, mainly at the top here. You might see it if you drive up all around these knobs here. So that's good. We've got a planting program of about 60,000 plants and trees over the next 3 years in the two blocks that we've just harvested and in here. And we've planted about 17,000 trees this last couple of months, just before this good planting season right now. So here's yours truly with Emma. We undertook a program. I won't be doing that again, I can tell you. That is quite a difficult challenge. But we got there by hook or by crook, and it's fantastic. So we've raised 1.25 to buy it, but we raised another million to develop it, which I've done with Emma. So we're well underway in there. I think it's one of these things, you have a once in a lifetime opportunity to buy the neighbour, generally. And we did, with a bit of jiggery pokery, we got there. And I just think the feedback we've had, I don't think we've had one negative comment from anyone, which, you know, normally you get a few sort of people throwing clods or something. So yeah, we were humbled by the response and the interest by the wider community. So again, what we learned out of this was we hadn't really, to this point, hadn't begun to tell our story. And once you start to tell your story, and you know, it's not a fanciful story, it's based in fact, and it's quite interesting, you get a lot of very, very positive engagement and money. So as part of this process, we consulted with the community. So this is the block, and this is our sort of proposed track network, which we made a big point of engaging with all of the community about, well, what do you think? What do you want? Like we did within the car parks, every 12 months we ask people about the whole park. So we engaged, we've got a project team on board, with engineers and specialist park planners and trustees and people like Mike Lusk, you know, people who know the area. So we built up quite a detailed plan, designing tracks, designing planting programs, and you'll see already if you've been up there recently, we're doing it in stages. So there's some bike tracks being basically built around this perimeter, and there's sort of an uphill track that's come up from Chambers Walk. It's been built. The Rongoa garden area, so that's a Maori medicinal garden. We're sort of halfway through that. We've done the hard landscaping and we've done first round of planting. So that involves consultation with a lot of people to get to that point. As I say, there's been a lot of planting done already. We've had community planting days as well, so we'll get onto that. So there's quite a bit in sort of buying and developing a piece of land. so we've learned, and it all costs money. That's our wider park here, and you can see that this is the bit that we bought, which sort of widens that. So that's the lower bit, that's Tower R, that's the main gate car park. That is quite a strategic point, and it was getting quite congested, so you can see how it fits. And we've got these sort of wider networks of tracks, which obviously since we've done some harvesting around here, so this was the old plantation block down here. So that's all been cleared. We got that out just after COVID. And then the plateau up here, which was about 8.5 hectares of old man pine, probably about 80 years old, and a reasonably good nick in the end, but that's all come out. So these tracks are sort of under review. We're looking at the whole network anyway, just to make sure that we've got the appropriate design, and where possible we can work with what we've got. So that's just an explanation of the Jack's Block. We've actually got a new signage program underway, which we got funded privately. So it's about a $70,000 project, just re-looking at how, you wouldn't believe how difficult it is doing signage in a park. We got junctions crossing over, you've got to work out, you know, clarity of what you're trying to explain. So even just trying to get a map of the park that people can actually discern is quite a challenge. And what we're trying to do is build in a bit of future-proofing, so you might be able to bring your smartphone, like I've got here, and just put it on that, and then you can know exactly where you are. But if you can get that working off, you know, the GPS or whatever, it's even better. So there's a whole lot of stuff that underpins the design of a fence post with a sticker on it. There's actually quite a bit of thinking behind it, and then it'll link to your online stuff as well. Anyway, there's sort of new signature signage starting to be rolled out through the park at the moment. We've had some public planning days. We had the kids involved. We had three of those, and they were fantastic. We had about, I think at the first one, about 100 people. Second one, pretty much the same. And then the third one, so this was in the new block, so this is all the people up there just planting. And what happens in the day, you get the public in, they do the planting or whatever. Then the next day you bring your experts in to make sure everything, you know, wasn't planted upside down or whatever, but that's okay. You know, worked out all right. This Mother Whenua turned up for the wrong guy. I wasn't there for that one. I was away, but I think there were about 70 people there, which is fantastic. So they got a blessing, and they did a lot of work clearing prior to that planting day. You know, there's a lot of getting rid of thistles and blackberry and stuff like that, so you can get into plantings. Yeah, so, you know, we're really excited. The uptake has been phenomenal in terms of support. And what we've learned is if you ask for help, people put their hand up and come, which is great, as long as you explain what you're doing and it's worthwhile. Okay, the forestry project, I just talked about it before. So we harvested these two separate blocks, you know, about 12 hectares. It was a significant project and we had significant hurdles. The Trust Board for a number of years refused to sort of deal with it for whatever reason. It was too hard, but we dealt with it and it was hard. So as you can see, this is in the old block, just sort of a track, and there are these trees falling down and this sort of stuff going on, which still looks great, but from a health and safety perspective, it's not great. So we had to do very, very detailed planning around how we were going to access the block, how we were going to make the surrounding areas safe while we were harvesting, and how we were going to protect important sites. So there were some putiki in there, some special rocks, a couple of midden sites. They had to be mapped off, and then when the logging occurs, then you've got to make sure that, you know, there's protocols and systems in place, or you might discover something, so what's the protocol around that? So there's quite a lot of work with that. And obviously, before you start these things, you've got to start with the end in mind. What do we want it to look like? So we developed a 3-year program of planting and how we're going to do it. So we had a community engagement and support plan as well. And most importantly, how are you going to fund it? Because at the end of the day, we had a lot of challenges around the access roads in and out. So when the previous trust board planted the plantation block, they thought they were going to get quite a bit of money. Well, the fact of the matter is, and COVID came, which was fantastic, because everything got held up. So we're trying to log in the middle of winter. Anyway, we broke even, which is, to me, a tremendous result. In fact, a magnificent result for 12 hectares of stuff. You know, the larger blocks had been pretty much untended, so it was in a rough state and quite difficult terrain. So, you know, a big, big project and a lot of risk that the Trust Board took on. And yeah, we got there. So if you remember, that's the old block, so from the plateau. So if you're looking at over sort of Tauro Valley and you're looking towards the peak, that's the road there, you know, coming up to the main gates. So this has all been harvested through here. And that's the plantation block, which is so looking right around. So that's Tauro Station there. So that's right around the southern side of the park. So the gap that you look through when you're on the plains here, that's where that was. So that's all come out. So that's just some pictures for you. Logging trucks, they had to cut a track up. So that's the old block in here. That's the redwoods just there. So we're coming up from the Tauro Valley. And then that's the plantation block. Looks a bit different, no trees. So we had to use the neighbour's skid site. The neighbours there allowed us to have a skid site. So that's looking back up towards Chambers Walk. It's on the other side of that brow. And some pretty big machinery in there. So that's what we ended up with. A mess. Yeah. There were some tracks there somewhere. See, there's the redwoods there. And then that's, you know, up to the goat track and what through there. And that's the plantation block from a different angle, from a drone. You know, you walk around the back to that red track around the back there and you go up to the peak. So that's looking out towards the Tukituk. So they did a pretty good job cleaning up. And there's mulching piles in here, which are actually causing a few problems because what happens is they heat up. So they've got to be spread fairly shortly because they become, you know, a fire risk. So what have we got now? Well, Eva's right. More views, more light, more native trees. So this is one of our planting days. That's looking down to that skid site down there. So all this valley has been planted. So we've got about 10,000 plants and trees in those valleys. That was done primarily professionally. So we had to pay for that, but done a fantastic job. We got most things in, so there's like totara and a lot of native stuff. The only things we couldn't get in with the Nio, they just weren't quite right. So we'll do that next year. But yeah, quite a big project and very, very exciting because, you know, these things will spring up over the next few years. And that's the vision. So what was pine then becomes native forest with the tracks sort of through there. And the Jack's Lock will be like that as well on the other side. So what's the future look like? Well, there's quite a lot of future going on now. So the master plan, and we'll probably have a better description of that, that's going to inform for the whole manga, not just what Tamata Park is, the vision and the values for the whole manga. That'll be quite detailed. And off that, we'll drive detailed management plans and various other things. So we're pretty close to finalising that. That'll be presented to council fairly shortly. And that will inform all strategic plans forevermore. So we'll just keep updating it regularly. And then, you have operational plans driven off that. Education, that's underway now. So Enviro Schools is a very, very important project. That's really where your local schools get engaged around, you know, working positively in the environment, like planting trees or clearing or whatever it is, flora, fauna. So we're fully engaged in that. We've got schools, I think three schools currently, working on programs in the park. So that's pretty fantastic. We've obviously got more planting coming. And what we'll do with this master plan, we'll develop, basically we'll chunk the whole park down into 10 square metre blocks, if you like. And we'll have a vision on, you know, planting, but also there's the culture element of it, there's flora, fauna, all that sort of stuff. So they have a register of stuff. And then from there, you will develop a plan for, I guess, a quadrant, an area of the park, whether it's a valley or a ridge or whatever. So, you know, that's been quite scientific of how you manage what you've got. And obviously, I talked before about wetlands. That's an area that we need to continue to work on. The regional council's got a lot of expertise in there, so we're talking with them about that. We just need to make sure that we're doing best by our wetlands and we're playing sympathetically. The wider manga, I've just talked about connectivity is fundamental. So we had a lot of hoo-ha about someone nearby who cut a track up the wrong side and was allowed to. Can't have that happening. So, you know, the connectivity is important. People do access the whole mountain at the moment and they come in across ridge lines and various other things. We just need to make sure that we've got a future design that's going to work. Because the reality is that people are getting around a lot more quick nowadays on their mini bikes or whatever, and they have a thirst for walking and doing a whole lot of stuff that wasn't happening before. So we've just got to make sure that the connectivity is there. And that comes through discussion and planning and leadership, which is what we're trying to provide here. Community engagement, that will continue. Volunteer days, a whole range of things. That's fundamental to what we do. The community being part of the story is really the key message here. So we've changed the trustee to include a mana whenua appointee. So we have a mana whenua subcommittee. I wrote to the Attorney General and said I want to change this because we have to go to the High Court to change the trustee. He wrote back to me and said, "Dear Mike, thank you for your letter." Apart from that, he said, "You don't have to do this, but given the cultural significance of the mountain, that is the right thing to do." And I think that's the important thing for everyone to understand here. That is the right thing to do. All this stuff is the right thing to do. And then I've established, with the behest of the Trust Board, an endowment fund. So we seeded that with, I think, $50,000 just recently from our own reserves. The aim here is to have 20 million in 20 years in there, which we'll get to. That's my background. So I have no doubt, once we tell our story better and we get engaged with the key people, we will get that money. And the reason we'll have that money is to protect and ensure that the manga will always be protected. So anyway, that's a key focus for us. We've got a 100-year anniversary coming up. We've commissioned a book as well, so we're working through quite a detailed research element of that. We've got an author, we're working with the Knowledge Bank, kick that off as well. So we've got a whole lot of information reposited in various places. That's the 100-year anniversary of the establishment of the park, of course. The idea is that the story will be told not just about the 100 years, but what's gone before as well. So what has gone before will inform the future. Sarah started this talk. So this is part of the connectivity. This is what they call the low track coming up from Waimarama Road. People may be familiar with it. Here's Craigie over here, like Voldemort. Do not speak their name. I love them. Right, so coming up the low track, that's what I'm calling the Lower Western Traverse. So there's always been some design in here. There's been quite a lot of acceptance by a bunch of landowners that that's the right thing to do. People always come across here. What we're trying to say here is that there's an accepted link coming in here in time. You can see that this is our new block here. There may be an opportunity to develop an access out the back through here. Who knows? And then there may be other opportunities to come into here. Who knows? But what you've got to think about is that it's the whole manga. It's not just here. There may be an opportunity to come in around the back here. Who knows? But you've got to be thinking about connectivity, because the fact of the matter is, it'll be less and less likely that people will be able to access the peak in a car in the medium term. It's just not in line with what's there, and it's not safe. But you can access it through planning, and everyone can have access to it, so it won't be cut off to anyone, but you have to allow for others that are less able to get there or whatever. So there's a lot of stuff coming that we need to plan for. And you know, accessing the parks in different ways is part of that. So it's just part of the challenge. What's quite interesting here, so this is our car park area here, of course, and the access point, you know, is a beautiful place. And obviously looking up along the ridgeline there, there's someone pointing out to Mount Erin. There you go. But it's a beautiful spot, isn't it? And we're very, very fortunate to be able to look after it.
Mike, it was inspirational. I'd just like to add that we all knew that Tamata struggled over the years with the pressures, and you join a group that have really changed the Hastings district. Tamata Peak's going to add to this. We have had the Pika Pika wetlands, which I know James Morgan was a huge fundraiser for, and we're quite proud that with the council we did Roy's Hill, the dump, and did all the planting there. Another thing is in the writings where the early pioneers said they were deafened by the native birds. And it's been years and years since people were deafened by native birds.
Mike, can you see the potential for a gondola?
No. Sorry, mate, but no.
When is the centenary? 2027. You mentioned the health and safety and what have you. Is it likely that you would need to fence any of the precipitous parts of the tracks?
Well, most of the precipitous parts of the park are currently fenced. There's a fencing program that's underway to upgrade those. We've done a health and safety sort of survey. So if there's specific risks identified, it has to be dealt with. Yeah, but you need to get independently audited as well. That's pretty important.
The native trees that you've planted, we just rely on the weather, the rain, or
irrigation he's talking about?
No, no, they just rely on the rain planting program and making sure they get a wet foot planted at the right time. Yeah. Yep. So yeah, challenges in that.
And for the wetlands, would you need to get a source of water in?
Well, you have plenty of sources of water. There's springs all over there. So the wetlands are, you know, they're wet because they have a source of water. They all need to be designed and thought through quite carefully.
Mike, I know that there is a native flax endemic to Tamata, and I think I've heard just recently this other native vegetation. Do you have a list?
Yeah, no, we've got lists of stuff. There's lists everywhere. So if you want a list of anything, you contact Emma Buttle, info@tamatapark.co.nz. She'll provide it.
Spreading those out into other areas.
There are planting programs, and part of that master planning process is how do we develop our indigenous flora and fauna. I mean, I might add, we've got quite a population of the black piwakawaka, which in the North Island is very, very rare, and they came to the fore while we had the middle lockdown post harvest. It was incredible. They just came out of the woodwork, literally. It's incredible what you do have there.
The Tamata Ridge, I presume, was created by upwards.
Yeah.
Evidence as to how far back?
Yeah, there is. I think it's quite a few hundred million years ago. Over the years, we've had various university geologists all over there. There's definitive information there. I just don't have it to hand.
Mike, in due course, there'll be less vehicular traffic going up the peak. That'll be cancelled right up.
Well, less free will. So yeah, there'll probably be vehicles going up there, but they might be, who knows, they could be green trains, you know, electric trains with just controlled access. So there'll be definitely vehicles going up there, but under.
You're talking also about the fact that it is, without doubt, our number one tourist place. What access are we going to give? the likes of us.
Yeah. Everyone should have a chance to see it, so that has to be worked through. But I mean, as I say, you could see, you know, an electric train going from the centre of Havelock. There's a myriad of options. Yeah. And this has been done before in New Zealand, you know, Mount Winston, those sort of places. You know, I think what we didn't discuss here is that in New Zealand there's two tipiness. So they are basically landscapes which are accorded the rights of a human. One's Whangarei River and the other is Mount Taranaki. The Mana Whenua are very keen to accord that status to Te Mata. And I don't see any reason why not. But that's quite a process. My point is that it's such a place of significance. And having people drive up at all times of day and night and doing whatever they're doing is just not acceptable at all. But having a well-structured, well-thought-through, well-developed strategy and plan to give people access in a way that's free, but does recognise various people's inabilities to get around or whatever, you know, but it's actually about control and safety and enjoyment of what's there. So that's really the philosophy behind that.
There's been a little bit of discussion about caves at the peak. Can you give us some definitive detail about that?
Marae Apatu wrote quite a detailed cultural report for Hawke's Bay, and that was sort of dusted off and then re-energised for the whole manga with the Craggy Track hua. So the mayor formed a group, which we were part of, and Craggy was, and a whole bunch of people were, and Marae was there, around the future of the manga. And we had to get through the initial issues they had. And part of that report and review, there's quite a definitive discussion around caves on that eastern escarpment. So there are caves up there. They're unsure whether they were used for any purpose, really, but they could be. That's the first thing. So there are a number of caves up there. And with limestone, you're going to get caves anyway, you know, the way they channel, obviously, the softness of the sandstone and stuff like that. Do we know every cave? No, we don't. There's a cave on a new block, which people might know of, the old Jess block. It was, I think, many years ago when many of you were young girls and boys. A couple of cars got stuck in the mouth of those caves. We've had quite a few cultural reports around sites of significance and caves in the park as well. So, I mean, the caves we know of, we've sort of marked. Most of those caves in the eastern escarpment can't be accessed because they're fenced off. Some of them actually aren't even in the park, they're below the park.
In terms of significant caves that you can go into, is there one, two, three or four?
You can't go into any of them, apart from the one on the Jack's block, which will be fenced off. So, in fact, no one should be able to get into any cave from a safety perspective.
Talking about back in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
One question I've got for you, Mike. When we first came here in 1970s, we heard that the houses were going to stop there, and they didn't. We saw them climbing higher and higher on the Havelock side. Do you know if there's a cut-off point for houses?
Oh, there is. Yeah, there are. But the western side, pretty much the side that faces here.
Open slope.
Oh, no, there's a line. Yes, between 180 and 200. It could change, you know. But from a cultural perspective, I mean, I think Māori said, look, Rangatira Whenua have said, let's just look after the eastern, the western is it is what it is. But yeah, there are rules. The key issue is making sure the rules are followed.
Well, Mike, it's fantastic. You've been part of this massive circle, and it's your inspiration and trust. Mike is obviously doing what has been needed, because that's what people have felt in their hearts for a long time. So I can't thank you enough.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Once again, thank you for coming.